Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends. The forces, both national and global, that shape our jobs, our incomes, our debts, what we pay for the goods and services we all depend on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write regular economic columns for truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news and analysis that provides commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. If you are interested in the analyses we do here, the materials we use, the approaches we are developing, then please visit our websites, where this material is gathered, where all these programs are archived, and where you can pursue whatever interests you from these radio and television broadcasts. The first website is my own, rdwolff.com. There you can see all the work I do, the written work, the videos, the audio recordings, classes, lectures, everything. And the other is our major project, Democracy at Work, a program, a movement to develop worker-owned, worker-operated enterprises. You can find everything about that subject at democracyatwork.info. So those are the two websites to contact, to pursue, to investigate. They're produced and updated daily for your use. Please also continue to send us your questions, your comments. We select a few, only a few of the many that come to respond to on the air. But we also use all of the others to shape our programs, what we talk about, how we approach it, and so on. And you can reach us, again, through the email mechanisms at either of the two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. Let me turn then to our updates for this week. One of the biggest news items was the report this last week by the Commerce Department about the second quarter growth in the GDP. It came in at 1.7%. Let's unpack and see what that means. First of all, GDP stands for gross domestic product. It's a rough number representing the output of goods and services actually achieved in the last 3 months, the last quarter. It was the second quarter of the year 2013. In the announcement, the Commerce Department also reduced its earlier estimate of first quarter growth down to barely 1%. To make it a long story short, what these numbers show, contrary to what you might be hearing from the media, is that we're not recovering real well in this economy. Let's take a look. In 2010, a disastrous year, the U.S. economy grew at a rate of about 2.3%. In 2011, 2.2%. In 2012, under 2%. And this year, the Federal Reserve estimates, well, maybe 2%, 2.25%. In other words, slow, inadequate economic growth to get us back to anything like what we were before this crisis hit in 2007. There is no recovery. Let me drive this point home further. Before the crisis hit, for the year of 2007, the unemployment rate in the United States was 4.7%. At the worst of the crisis, 2010, 9 and 10, it hit 10%. And today, it's 7.6%. Do the math. From 10% to 7.6% is not even halfway back to where we were in 2007, meaning that the vast millions added to the unemployment rolls in this country are still there. That's not a recovery. It wasn't good to have 4.7% unemployment back in 2007, and it's much, much worse to have it at 7.6% today. At the same time, over these 4 years that we have not gotten back to where we were before, where we have not recovered, what do we have? We have a growing level of debt, particularly and very ominously among the youngest and brightest of our people. Students have been accumulating debts more than any other group in our society. The total amount of student debt now exceeds the total amount of credit card debt in the United States. Young people are mortgaging their future. So on top of the inadequate recovery of production, on top of no recovery at all in unemployment compared to where we were before the crisis, we have growing student debt. And all of this lackluster economic performance, to say the least, on top of that, what is even enabling this amount of disappointing economic growth? Here's what it is. Every month, the Federal Reserve pumps $85 billion of new money into the economy by buying bonds and other instruments from banks, insurance companies, the rich who own those things, and so on. Now, do the math with me. $85 billion a month. That's a support, a stimulus from the Federal Reserve of over $1 trillion a year. Staggering support. This is an economic system performing poorly while it's on life support from the Federal Reserve. That's why you can understand the hoopla over the last few months when there were rumors and then statements by Mr. Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, that they might taper down their pumping of money into the economy. For an economy that's on life support, reducing that life support risks death, and the stock market reacted accordingly. For an economy on life support of this nature to be performing so poorly underlines the point. There is no recovery for the mass of the American people. Let me turn now to several other shorter economic updates. First, you know, when thieves fall out amongst themselves, suddenly you can learn a lot about what they've been doing when they're arguing against each other. And it turns out the same happens with big corporations. Let me give you an example. In 2010, the Gulf of Mexico experienced a traumatic oil spill. It was called the Deepwater Horizon Rig. It blew up. The explosion killed 11 workers, and it fouled hundreds of miles of beaches, destroyed the fishing industries, damaged plant life in the water and on the coast. Unspeakable ecological disaster. Three companies have been involved in suits by the authorities for criminal activity. British Petroleum, better known as BP, Halliburton, and Transocean. These companies, respectively, mine for, bring up, and distribute oil and gasoline. You all know the BP station on the corner. Transocean and Halliburton produce and operate rigs that bring up the oil for BP from deep locations, excuse me, in the ocean. So far, the government has gone after the criminal behavior of these companies. So, for example, Halliburton recently had to pay a $200,000 fine. Well, don't cry right away. The revenues of Halliburton are north of $25 billion a year. For them, $200,000 in a fine to pay for criminal action is like you committing a fine and the judge sternly looking at you and telling you your fine will be 25 cents. But they also made a voluntary contribution of $55 million to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. How interesting, the timing of their voluntary contribution. BP had to pay even more, $4.5 billion in penalties. It pleaded guilty to no less than 14 criminal charges. And Transocean, they paid $400 million, and they also pled guilty. Criminal charges. But these are small potato fines for such companies. BP, BP had annual revenues of nearly $400 billion. So for them, a $4 billion fine, 1% of 1 year's activity for that company. Nothing that they're going to lose any sleep over. But the big problem is civil suits. All the damaged fishing companies, all the damaged resort companies, all the damaged beachgoers and beachfront owners, all the sufferers from all the states impacted by the criminal behavior of Transocean, Halliburton, and BP. And so the fear of these companies is, who's going to have to pay all those civil claims? So they're accusing each other. Halliburton's being accused of not having made cement according to specifications, and BP is being accused of having been lax in its supervision. How interesting. And how important the lesson here. We entrust vital things to our big corporations, and they don't perform real well. And if anyone else performed that badly, there'd be a lot more than slaps on the wrist. There'd be a real debate in this country about whether letting our waterways, our ecological survival, be kept in the hands of people who are putting their own profits and those of their enterprises way ahead and even at conflict with the needs of the people. My apologies for my allergy. Our next economic update has to do with a different way of looking at poverty. Instead of measuring at a moment how many people fall below a certain line, which is the usual way this is done, there's been a new study that's going to be published next year by Oxford University Press. The lead researcher in that study is a fellow named Rank, and I want to mention his name, Mark Rank, a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And he's done an interesting thing. He's developed a measure called economic security, or rather economic insecurity. And you face economic insecurity, he says, if a year or more of periodic joblessness, reliance on government aid, such as food stamps, or you have an income below 150% of the poverty line. In other words, if this kind of risk is something you face and experience at least one or more times in your life, then you are considered to be in a condition of economic security. And here's the stunning result of his research. 4 out of 5 adults in America, 79% of our people, struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least parts of their lives. That's the reality today. That's how far down capitalism in America has brought the mass of people, the overwhelming majority, from the kinds of conditions they once enjoyed back in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. How much has changed, and how hard the reality for life is for Americans. Because remember, the anxiety that you will be in this condition of insecurity is as bad in many cases as actually going through it. Worrying all your life, the tension, the heartache, the heart attacks. Think of all the decisions made by people facing insecurity who choose a job they think will be more secure rather than the job they love, the job for which they studied, the job they would enjoy doing, and the job they would be much more productive if they were doing. But they don't. Insecurity makes them choose something else. Not only are they less happy in their lives, but they produce less well for the rest of us. Multiply that by millions of people, and you can imagine the cost of the economic insecurity we impose on our fellow citizens. The third update today is one I want to really hammer home. This has to do with Detroit, which we spoke about several times over the last few weeks. The reason being, Detroit is a disaster of a city, going through a bankruptcy, imposing cuts of pensions on retired city workers, and now we learn they're selling the paintings, even of the great Mexican muralist Diego Rivera, in order to raise the money to limp through a city that has lost more than half its population since the 1950s. But here we hear something else. The governor of the state of Michigan, Rick Snyder, proudly unveiled a $650 million expenditure in Detroit. You know what for? A hockey arena for the Detroit Red Wings. And half of that money, $325 million, in a city that can't provide basic services for its people, basic supports for its streets and its parks. They're going to build another stadium with $325 million worth of public money. And you know the argument they give, the lame, false argument of the governor? This will improve and bring back Detroit. To get a sense of the dishonesty involved here, consider this. This will be the third publicly funded stadium in Detroit in recent time. The Tigers baseball team, Comerica Stadium, and the Lions football team, Ford Field. Each of those was billed as a remedy for the city in recent years. And the bankruptcy announced 2 weeks ago tells you what a hype that was. What an unmet promise that was. To do that now, in the face of the city's bankruptcy, adding a third stadium with promises that have been shown not to come true, is an extraordinary act at an extraordinary, tragic time in that city's history. Finally, and briefly, much attention over the last week or two has been devoted to the new baby in Great Britain, baby of the royal family, Prince William, and his son, George Alexander Louis. But here's a little recorded fact. When Prince William became a new father, he was entitled under British law to 2 weeks of paid paternity leave. That's right. That's the law in England. They want to make sure that a new father has at least 2 weeks of paid leave. On top of that, Britain guarantees new parents a full year of leave. They are not paid for the full year, but they have a full year, and their employer has to take them back, give them an equivalent amount of seniority, accrue vacation and other benefits along the way, etc. And not only that, but the husband and wife can have one of them take the full year of unpaid guaranteed leave, or they can split it, for example, 26 weeks each. Many countries in Europe have even more generous plans. And here's the point. Not only does the United States provide no required paid maternity or paternity leave, but we're the country that says all the time how we're committed to family values. We don't give paternity leave paid in our law. We don't provide 52 weeks of guaranteed leave in our law. Nothing even close. We don't match the Europeans in paid leave for new parents, and we don't match them in unpaid guaranteed leaves. When it comes to money, our commitment to family values doesn't seem to go very far. And when it comes to the Europeans, we like to criticize. They talk much less about family values, but they do a lot more to support the family than we do. Let me turn now to more substantive discussions of major topics that I know many of you are interested in, because we choose these in part on those comments and criticisms and suggestions you email to us through our websites, rdwolf.com with two F's, and democracyatwork.info. I want to look at some statistics gathered on the 31st of July in the New York Times by their periodic writer, Eduardo Porter. And you can find the full research reported there, but I want to talk a little bit about it because it tells us something about the United States and, again, about our comparison with other countries. The statistic that is the focus of that article and of many people's research is what economists call disposable income. Let me be sure we're all on the same page in that regard. Disposable income is what you have left, basically, after you pay your taxes. How much of the income you earn is really disposable, available to you, and not taken away by the government? And so, Mr. Porter, using statistics that are publicly available, and you can find out more by pursuing his work and that story on the 31st of July. If you pursue that, you discover the following. Over the first decade of this new century, that is between the years 2000 and 2010, selected advanced countries were looked at to see what happened to their disposable income. That is, on the average, how much more or less money did people have to spend after they paid their taxes in 2010 compared to the year 2000. And this may come as a surprise. The outstanding performer, Australia. Their disposable income went up a whopping 40%. Much more modest, Britain. Its disposable income on average went up 14%. Germany, more modest still, saw its disposable income go up 2%. And the United States saw the disposable income, the average disposable income of Americans, drop by 4%. That's right, drop. Over a 10-year period, Americans deteriorated in what they were able to buy once they had earned their money and paid their taxes. So if you feel that life has gotten harder over the last 10 years, or by now 13 years, of this new century, and you are wondering about that, wondering whether you're unusual and everybody else is doing well, here's the news. You're right. The notion that other people are doing well is a fantasy maintained by people with a vested interest in keeping that fantasy going. Just as the opening of this program told you, there's no recovery. These statistics in the New York Times of July 31st tell you that your sense that your disposable income is shrinking, and with it, your life chances for the things you dreamed of and wanted to provide to yourselves and your children, that is shrinking, you feel that way, you're right. The statistics bear you out. Let's stay with that a little bit longer and compare the United States to some others. What is the question, for example, that Mr. Porter asked himself? How do we do in terms of deaths per thousand infants? You know, what's our infant mortality rate like? Given that we're a society that's supposed to be so rich and well off, and facing the fact that our disposable income has reduced, how do we compare to other countries on something as vital as giving newborns a chance at life? Well, he looked at 20 countries, Mr. Porter did, and he found that among 20 countries, advanced industrial countries, whose names you all know, Britain, Canada, Mexico, Netherlands, Spain, Germany, and so on, the United States ranks fourth worst out of the top 20 countries in terms of infant mortality. The three countries that are worse than we are in that, Turkey, Mexico, and the Slovak Republic. And among the countries that are better off than we are, where newborns have a much greater chance to survive and live, I'll just list a few. Greece, Germany, Ireland, Spain, Austria, Switzerland, Denmark, Italy, Netherlands. Oh, you get the picture? Let me give you another number. Percentage of households with children living below 50% of the national median income. Percentage of households where kids are really poor. Again, the top 20 countries. We're the fourth worst. countries worse than us, that is having more kids living in poverty, Turkey, Mexico, and Poland. Countries with less people living in poverty, just a partial list, Britain, Czech Republic, South Korea, Netherlands, Australia, Luxembourg, Greece, Japan, New Zealand, Canada, you get the picture. And here's one I thought might touch again on that family values issue. The percentage of children living in households with only one parent. 20 countries. The United States ranks number one. More children in the United States live in a household with only one parent than in any other country that the OECD, the gatherer of these data, can find. We know that families with only one parent are relatively poor, poorer than families with two, for the obvious reason that one person's income has to cover the family, not two. And we know as well how hard it is for one person to raise children, what extra difficulties of all kinds it places on the hopes and dreams of those kids. We're the society that has more people living in single-parent households than any other of the advanced countries. If you have felt life has gotten harder in the United States over the last 15, 20 years, you're right on the money. That's the truth. And if you feel that way, it's because you understand correctly what's going on. My second longer discussion, and one I want to take a few moments with you to do today, has to do with what I would call stunned disbelief. Once again, my stunned disbelief turns to banks. They really are quite a group in our society. They make other capitalists look positively benign when you contemplate what they are able and willing and determined to do, despite getting caught, despite getting fined, punished, pilloried in the public press, they just go right ahead. What's the latest one? Well, it turns out, recent stories have begun to show, including in the major newspapers of the United States, that banks have declined, and in many cases, ejected about 10 million Americans. They've been unable to get a checking account. The banks have said, oh, you bounced a check, or oh, you overdrew an account, or oh, you forgot to make a payment. Whatever it is, very small infractions have become basis for saying, we're canceling your account. 10 million Americans. Jonathan Mintz, the commissioner in the Department of Consumer Affairs in New York City, counts 825,000 New Yorkers, almost a million in that one state alone, who have been unable to get or been denied or been ejected from a checking account. Now, let's talk a little bit about this. If you don't have a checking account, you can't qualify for all kinds of benefits. You have to pay higher fees for all kinds of things because you have to use cards that come with those fees that are more expensive than a checking account ever was. You can't solve certain kinds of economic problems. It adds to your costs. These are usually poor people, so the costs are an extra burden. This is incredibly unfair to the least of our fellow citizens. It is, in short, outrageous. Why have the banks done this? Their answer, looking you right in the face, and I'm talking here Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, the giants of the industry. It's not profitable. We don't want to do it. And so we're not gonna. Let's review. Part of the reason is that the Congress, after the meltdown of 2008, said that banks couldn't charge enormous fees. Fine, said the bank. If we can't milk fees out of those we've got, we're going to get rid of those that cost us anything. We'll boost our profits one way or the other. Let me remind everyone here. These are the banks that got enormous public bailouts. Your and my tax money in the billions was used to help these banks through. What had they done? They had gotten fraudulent estimates of the value of certain instruments they were marketing in cahoots with the rating companies. They have had to pay fines for money laundering, for excessive fee charging, for manipulating the LIBOR interest rates in England, and on and on. We bailed them out. We watched them flaunt the law and the public trust. And now they're doing it again. We rewarded them with help when they made enormous infractions that shook the whole world economy, had a lot to do with millions of people losing their jobs. We helped them. Their response now when their profits are pinched, and by the way, they're doing very well, just pinched relative to what they want to do, they tell 10 million Americans, no checking account for you. It is extraordinary. And it leads to a conclusion before we take our mid-program break. Why do we permit banks to be private enterprises when they behave this way? When they made outrageous decisions that plunged the world into a global economic catastrophe we're still living through? When they have admitted and paid fines for money laundering, interest rate manipulation, overcharging of fees, and on and on and on. We now permit them to deny 10 million Americans a checking account because they bounced a check or whatever other excuse is used. This isn't believable, is it? Suppose we took over the bank, said, you're a national resource. We can't let you do what you want because we all depend on it. We might think of banks sort of like we think of the post office. It's a public service. Just like a checking account and a savings account ought to be. It's something you provide to your people as a matter of minimal decency. And guess what would happen then? Would the 10 million poorer Americans be denied? No. You know what happens to the post office when people suggest, oh, we can save money in the post office by just cutting off all the towns and villages that need a post office in their area? Those people fight back, and because it's a public service, they hold on. They have to fight, but they hold on. If banks were run like the post office, maybe then we could make sure they behave, not perfectly, not without a fight, but that they serve the public interest rather than serving their own at the public's expense. We're going to take our mid-program break. It's very short, and I look forward to returning with you in a few moments. Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I am your host, Richard Wolff. And once again, before we leap back into our economic analyses for today, I want to remind you that if these topics are interesting, if you find this kind of analysis to your liking and would like to pursue more of it, please visit either or both of our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. We update and expand those websites on a daily basis to provide you with this kind of analysis, this kind of an approach. And if the radio program is of interest, please pursue your interest there as well. And also, both websites provide you with ways to send us your comments, your criticisms, your questions, which we use in shaping and developing this program. I want to turn next to a topic that many of you have asked me to talk about, namely labor unions in the United States, and particularly their current situation and the perception that Americans have of them. And there have been some recent polls produced by the Gallup organization and the Pew, P-E-W, Trust. They are regular pollers on this question, so they have a nice track record. And before I get to the poll results that are interesting, let me remind you that the labor movement has been in a 50-year decline in the United States. Today, in the private sector, less than 7% of workers who work for a private employer are in or represented by a trade union. That's right. 93% of workers in the private sector have no union, are not represented by a union. Keep that statistic in mind, both as we go through today's analysis, but also as a corrective, as a reality check. The next time you hear someone talk about powerful unions in the United States, they living in a fantasy world. True, in the public sector, which is much the smaller sector in this country, in the public sector, unions still represent somewhere between 25 and 30% of employees. But notice, in the public sector too, the vast majority of workers have no union and are not represented by a union. The notion that unions are powerful institutions is a fantasy of right-wing ideologues and those who had never bothered to look at the basic numbers as they have been declining over the last 50 years. Given how small and how weak unions have become and how few workers are represented by them, you might be intrigued to know that even though the favorable rating, the way people in America feel about unions, even though that's been declining for 50 years as well, it hasn't declined anywhere near as much. So in the latest polling, June of 2013, the polls indicate that more than half the American people approve of unions, roughly 52%. That's right, 52% of people approve of unions, even though less than 7% of workers in the private sector have one. And if you think it's impressive that 52% of Americans approve of unions, if you look at people under 30 years of age, it jumps to 61%. Even though those younger people have even fewer union memberships than older Americans. That's right. The younger workers are virtually ununionized, but have a very strong, better than 60%, favorable attitude towards unions. Here's what this all means. The American union movement isn't in anywhere near as bad a shape as their membership numbers would indicate. Because even though they haven't been able to hold their members, there is in the population a strong feeling that unions are something working people need. Well, here's one conclusion you could draw from this. Maybe the problem is that the unions haven't figured out the kind of strategy that would translate into new members joining. A kind of strategy that would take people who are favorable to unions to take the next step of joining or forming a union where they work. If that's a reasonable way to think, then the next logical step would be to say, well, when was the last time people who were favorable to a union made the decision to join one or to form one? Maybe that'll be a clue. Here comes the answer. Back in the 1930s, in a time of depressed economic conditions, even worse than those we're in now, but of the same kind of broad quality, American workers became very favorably inclined. We don't have polls quite from that time. Gallup and Pew weren't doing their work, so we can't make a comparable measure, but we can see it. But then what happened was even more interesting. The favorable attitude translated into working people doing something. And here's what they did. First, they formed and joined labor unions on a scale we've never seen before in American history and we've never seen since. Millions of people who had never been members of a trade union joined in the depths of the Depression of the middle of the 1930s. Many of them also joined socialist and communist political parties because they wanted to see the labor side of the equation be even more aggressive, not just bargaining with the employer for better wages and working conditions, but moving on to changing the economy in the interest of working people, to socialism and communism, which expressed the way these people wanted to translate their favorable attitude into real action. So what do I draw as the conclusion? Maybe what the trade union and labor union movement needs today is to ask itself, how do we translate the favorable attitude of a majority of American people, and an even bigger majority of young people, into action? If a page from the 1930s is worth taking, here's the answer. Become much more militant. Become much more an initiative taker. Go on. Say the truth. That corporations are ripping the place off. That the government is under the thumb of those corporations. And that nothing short of a mass movement that you, the labor movement, are prepared to lead can change this. If the mass of people already favorable to unions could see them taking leadership in changing this society, maybe that would get them to make that switch from mere favorableness to action. It worked in the 1930s for the unions, for the socialist and the communist parties. Let's see who takes that kind of initiative and reaps that kind of benefit in our conditions today. As I turn to the final section of today's program, let me ask you again to stay with me and consider the following. Many of you have asked me questions over an extended period of time in which you understood my stress on beginning to consider the benefits of having enterprises not run in the classical capitalist way. That is, not owned by a handful of major shareholders, the way most American enterprises are. Not run by a board of directors selected exclusively by those major shareholders, like most larger corporations in Americans are. But instead, a democratic enterprise. An enterprise in which the workers democratically operate their enterprise. The decisions now made by major shareholders and boards of directors would then instead be made by the workers democratically. So the decision, what will this company produce, will be made democratically. What technology, how will we go about producing, will be made democratically. Where the enterprise will do its production, where it will be located, will be decided democratically. And perhaps most important, what will be done by the profits made together by all the workers, that too would be decided democratically. And I know you've heard me explain that it is rather bizarre in a country that is committed to democracy, as we here in the United States say 10 times a day, and as so many other countries around the world insist they are committed to equally, that in many of those countries, as in the United States, the reality is that the place where adults spend most of their time in their lives, which is the workplace, 5 out of 7 days at least, you get up, you get dressed, you grab some coffee, and you go to your workplace where you spend the next 8 or more hours of your creative time, devoting your brains and your muscles to working, and then you go home. If you put together the preparation, the travel, your workplace is the place where you spend most of your life. If you're committed to democracy, why in the world wouldn't it apply to the place you spend most of your life? What possible justification is there to exclude the workplace from the commitment you say you have to democracy? Once this is basically understood, many of you then wonder, gee, how could worker-owned, worker-operated enterprises get off the ground? And even if they did, how could they grow and develop? Where would the money come from? And I've always found it intriguing that this question would worry you. Money would be gotten by worker enterprises pretty much the way money was gotten by capitalist enterprises. Some capitalist enterprises start with the money of the individual who begins it. Some worker self-directed enterprises could begin by putting together the money that the workers who start this collect. And as they grow and more workers join them, they bring some of their savings, some of their family's resources. That could happen, has happened. No problem there. And if more money is needed, maybe worker self-directed enterprises could borrow from banks. Private banks, public banks. Here's another way. Maybe a workers operated enterprise could issue shares of stock, showing what it has as a business plan and how it expects to grow. It could get people to invest in it. That's what capitalist enterprises did, and there's in principle no problem for worker self-directed enterprises to do that, and there are plenty of examples where that has in fact happened. And here's another one. Governments could say that they want their people to have a chance to see what worker self-directed enterprises are like, how they work, what it's like to work in them. And so they want their people to have freedom of choice. Yeah, they can work in a capitalist enterprise, but they have the freedom of choice to go work in a worker self-directed enterprise, a democratic enterprise. And then they can choose which satisfies them the more, which makes them feel more like a person, etc. And a government that was committed to that would set aside the money to help worker self-directed enterprises, worker co-ops, whatever you want to call them, get off the ground, get access to capital. Government already provides capital for minority businesses. The government provides extra help and support and subsidies to small businesses to create the opportunity for people to see how they function in the community. Well, worker self-directed enterprises could and should get the same support. All of those are sources of capital. But now let me take this another step, and it's an important step. Let's take a look at exactly what capital means. Absolutely correct for all of you who said to me in your communications, after all, businesses need money. They need to get at the resources needed to buy machines and equipment, as well as to hire people. In other words, you need capital and labor in the ways that this was communicated. Fine. But let's ask the question. Where did the people and institutions who have capital, who have the money to lend or invest in a worker co-op, where exactly did it come from? How did they get it? And I think if you follow me in this, you'll see the importance of tracing it back. When you work in a capitalist enterprise, as you all know, even if you've never put it into these words, you know the following is true. If your job pays you $20 an hour, $200 an hour, whatever, you're only getting paid that by your capitalist employer because in every hour you work, you produce more in the way of goods and services that that employer will then sell than it costs him to have you there. Because the difference between what you produce by your labor per hour and what the employer pays you, that's his profit. That's why he's in business. And that's why if you don't produce more than he pays you, either you're going to take a pay cut or you're going to get fired. That's how the capitalist system works. Well, what does the employer do with the extra you produce for him over and above what he pays you to come there? Part of that money, the surplus produced by workers, by all of us, the profits that the company gets from hiring all of us and putting us to work. Part of that money is paid out to shareholders, and part of that money is retained by the company as its investment fund, its capital. And indeed, the shareholders take a part of what they get, their cut of this surplus, and that's capital they have to invest. Which means that when we discuss workers together in an enterprise that they democratically operate, when they go and ask for capital to help build their businesses, to take on more worker members, to be better able to produce goods and services and so on. What they're asking for is the surplus produced by other workers, but that was taken into the hands of employers. But the ultimate creators of the capital that workers want is other workers. And if you had a society of worker self-directed enterprises, all of whom produced more than the workers in them themselves got, that would be a general fund, perhaps maintained by a government agency or by some local agency, that all the local worker self-directed enterprises could tap. You know what it's like? It's like the National Guard, what I'm talking about. Let me explain. We maintain, at the public expense, a National Guard in every one of our 50 states. A group of people with offices and barracks and storehouses where they maintain vehicles and tools and equipment. And whenever the communities of our states need help, they can appeal to the governor, who will send in the National Guard to deal with an emergency, to deal with a special need. So here's a resource that we all contribute to that's made available to all of us, distributed according to need. Suppose capital were handled this way. Suppose the surplus everybody produces at his or her job, in the office, in the store, in the factory. Suppose that surplus didn't become the private property of an employer, distributed by him to rich shareholders, or kept in the company vault, so that the rest of us had to go appeal to them to get a piece of it. Suppose instead, since we all help produce the profits that a few get, all the workers help produce it, that it becomes instead a public resource, like the National Guard. And that all enterprises can come and say, here, we'd like some of that. We need it to grow. We need it to expand. We need it to make our workers more efficient, whatever. And there would be a distribution system, like we now distribute the services of the National Guard, to meet the needs of the enterprises we all depend on. That would be a community, democratically run system of capital, and would be the nice partner for a democratically run series of enterprises. Democratic enterprises appealing to a democratically organized capital fund that recognizes where all capital comes from. The surplus produced by workers in countless enterprises who all produce more for the employer than the employer pays them. But instead of allowing that to be the private domain of people you have to beg to make an investment in what you're doing, it becomes what it probably should have been all along, a collective resource since it's the product of collective behavior, and is then available to help workers' democratic enterprises grow. That would be a better way of managing the capital requirements of an economy based on worker self-directed enterprises, even though such an economy could develop on the older traditional sources of asking individuals to invest, asking banks to lend, having the people actually working in the enterprise bring the funds themselves, selling shares, etc. In the time that we have left, the few minutes that we have left, I wanted to explore one final topic of the day that struck me as extraordinarily important. Over the last week, it was discovered that dinosaur bones, an extraordinary collection of dinosaur bones, were uncovered in a part of the United States in the far west. And the stories began to swirl that these dinosaur bones were being purchased, put up for sale and purchased by private enterprises. And it led me to think. It's extraordinary, you know, in a society that values things, to allow very scarce, very exceptional, very beautiful, very educational items to be taken away from the public that could benefit from access to them and put inside somebody's private collection. Very interesting decision is being made there, that an individual can simply take for himself or herself what is really not anything they produced and is in fact something that the whole society could benefit from, and they can keep it from the society that would benefit from it. And that's what's going on with those dinosaur bones in the West. They're not going to be, apparently, in a museum. They're going to be purchased by a collector who's going to do whatever he wants. That's what private property means. Whatever he wants. Hide them. Allow them to be viewed only by friends and associates. Charge a huge price for anyone else. Whatever the private owner wants. And thinking about that reminded me of the history of our own civilization. I remember over the years how often my students were amazed when I explained to them that for many centuries in what we now refer to as the medieval history of Europe, feudal Europe, for many centuries, it was not possible in Europe to buy or sell land. That's right, land was not purchasable. And why is that? Well, the answer is simple. In those days, it was put religiously. God put the land there. Human beings have no right to buy and sell it as if it were theirs. Translation: the land is everybody's, the land we all need. Nobody should be in a position to deny the community what it needs simply because that person has some private property claim. Thank you very much for your attention, as always. This is Richard Wolff. The program is Economic Update, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Your time now, baby. After a while, going to be mine, won't be mine. One of these days, babe, I'm moaning, droning, babe. Try, try, won't be long.